From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dean Ulsher, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, the new film Affliction examines the cycle of male violence within a family. We'll hear from Russell Banks, who wrote the novel the film is based on, and we'll hear from Nick Nolte, who stars both in Affliction and in the new film The Thin Red Line. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by pianist Tommy Flanagan, and film critic John Powers reviews Hillary and Jackie. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. After meeting behind closed doors for most of the day, the Senate has given unanimous approval to a framework for the impeachment trial of President Clinton. The plan calls for the trial to resume on Thursday, with 3 days of opening presentations from each side, the House prosecutors and the White House defense team. The Senate could then vote to adjourn or continue the trial and hear from witnesses. If witnesses are called, a majority of the senators would have to approve each witness. House Judiciary Committee Chairman Henry Hyde said the House prosecutors look forward to calling witnesses. The White House lawyers accepted the Senate's decision today and promised a vigorous defense of the president, NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
In private, White House aides said the plan was not ideal, but it had elements they could work with. In public, White House counsel Gregory Craig said the president's lawyers were ready to begin the trial next week.
The Senate has decided how it wants to proceed. We respect that. And in accordance with the procedures adopted by the Senate, we plan to present, on behalf of the president, a vigorous, successful, and complete defense.
The plan that passed the Senate today gave the White House one thing it wanted very badly. The opening statements from the White House and the House managers will be confined to the record of the House impeachment hearings. That means the House managers will not be able to surprise the White House at that time with brand new evidence, such as affidavits from other women, the so-called Jane Does, whose testimony was never entered into the House record. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
Winter weather swept across much of the country today, bringing snow, sleet, and freezing rain. Snow fell from the northern plains across the Great Lakes and into the northeast. Much of the southeast got rain, and the middle Atlantic got a mixture of both. MCI WorldCom says it has decided not to join the bidding contest for wireless company AirTouch. The announcement leaves only Bell Atlantic and Britain's Vodafone vying for the company. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
Over the past few days, there have been reports that MCI WorldCom had verbally offered to buy San Francisco-based AirTouch for an unspecified amount of stock. MCI WorldCom has become the nation's second-largest long-distance company through a series of aggressive mergers. But today, the company issued a statement saying it had decided not to pursue a deal. The company did not explain the decision. AirTouch, which was once part of Pacific Telesis, is the dominant wireless company on the West Coast. The company confirmed earlier this week that it has received a merger offer from Bell Atlantic, the nation's largest local phone company. The offer was followed by a second bid from Vodafone, Britain's largest mobile phone company. AirTouch officials say they are considering the offers. Jim Zeroli, NPR News, New York.
The Dow Industrials gained 105 points today to close at a record 9,643. This is NPR. President Clinton warned Japan today that unless it cuts back exports of cheap steel to the U.S. market, his administration will impose punishing tariffs on Japanese steel. U.S. steelmakers and the Steelworkers Union have complained that Japanese steel exports to the U.S. have risen by 400% in the past year, costing the industry millions of dollars in profits and the loss of thousands of jobs. They say Japanese companies are dumping their steel at less than it costs to produce it in an effort to keep afloat in their sagging economy. The Prime Minister of Malaysia has announced a massive cabinet reshuffling. Francis Harrison reports.
Since Anwar Ibrahim was fired last September, the posts of Finance Minister and Deputy Prime Minister have been left vacant. The Foreign Minister, Abdullah Ahmed Badawi, becomes Mahathir Mohamad's new deputy. Observers say the Prime Minister was probably looking for a number two who wouldn't threaten him at a time when he's under intense scrutiny for the way he's treated Anwar. A loyal confidant has been appointed as Finance Minister, Daim Zainuddin, a man who held the post during the last recession in the 80s. Asked by journalists to react to calls for his resignation, Mahathir said the only pressure for him to step down came from the foreign press, who should go and ask their own ministers to resign. For NPR News, I'm Frances Harrison in Kuala Lumpur.
Israeli police say they'll deport 14 Americans who are alleged to have plotted violence in Jerusalem in the belief that it would hasten the return of Jesus Christ. A police spokesman said police will escort the 14 members of concerned Christians to the airport for a flight to Denver, Colorado. The 14 sect members include 6 children. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR Business News comes from the Kauffman Center for Entrepreneurial Leadership, based at the Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation, providing resources for entrepreneurs on the web at entreworld.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dean Olscher, NPR cultural correspondent, filling in for Terry Gross. The new Paul Schrader film Affliction opens in many theaters around the country this month. Affliction is based on a novel by Russell Banks. It's the portrait of two sons of an abusive alcoholic father. Nick Nolte's performance as the older brother, Wade, has earned him a Golden Globe nomination for Best Actor, and he won that category among the National Society of Film Critics and the New York Film Critics Circle. Let's hear a clip from the film with Nolte and Willem Dafoe, who plays the younger brother, Rolf.
I've been thinking about that story you told me about Pop. Chopping the firewood out of the ice and after. I don't want to disappoint you, but I don't think it happened.
You don't think I'd remember a thing like that?
It wasn't me. I wasn't there. I heard about it. When I heard about it, it was Elborn.
Well, Elborn, geez, we have to go digging in Vietnam to ask him.
And Elborn and Mom brought you to the doctor and told him you fell from the hayloft.
Well, I never heard that one.
No, I remember clearly because after I heard, I became real careful around Pop. I was a careful child, and I became a careful adult. But at least I was never afflicted by that man's violence.
That's what you think.
That's a scene from the film Affliction. We'll hear from Nick Nolte later on this Friday archive edition of Fresh Air. But first, a visit with the author of the book on which the film is based, Russell Banks. Banks says in Affliction he tried to understand the consequences of having been beaten by his own father. The novel asks if it's possible to break the chain of male violence. Banks grew up in New Hampshire. His father was a plumber, his grandfather was a plumber, and in the early 60s, he was a plumber, too. Affliction is narrated by Rolf Whitehouse, who tells the story of how his brother Wade turned into a man even more violent than his father. Terry Gross interviewed Russell Banks in 1989.
I'd like you to do a reading from Affliction, and this is a scene in which the father who beats his wife and his children is confronting his son, and the son has to figure out what to do. And this is the older son in the book, Wade.
Yeah, Wade White. Wade is the protagonist really of the novel, and we're dealing with him as an adult for the most part, for 2 weeks in his life really. But this scene, and it takes place when he's about 16 years old, it's really his part of his essential childhood. He's tried to confront his father in the middle of a quarrel between his father and mother. And the father says, "You're telling me, you are trying to tell me what I'm supposed to be afraid of? You think I'm afraid of you?" He showed his large teeth and made a quick move toward Wade. And when Wade jumped, he stopped and folded his arms over his chest and laughed. "Jesus H. Christ," he said. "What a candy ass." Without thinking it, Wade reached behind him into the dish rack, and his hand wrapped itself as if of its own volition around the handle of the skillet, heavy black cast iron, and he lifted it free of the rack and swung it around in front of him. The sound of his heart pounded in his ears like a hammer against steel, and he heard his voice, high and thin in the distance, say to his father, "If you touch her or me or any of us again, I'll kill you." His father quietly said, "Jesus." He sounded like a man who had just broken a shoelace. "I mean it. I'll kill you." He lifted the skillet in his right hand and held it out and just off his shoulder like a ping-pong paddle, and he suddenly felt ridiculous. Without hesitation, Pop walked quickly around the table, came up to his son, and punched him straight in the face, sending the boy careening back against the counter and the skillet to the floor. Grabbing him by his shirt front, Pop hauled the boy back in front of him and punched him a second time and a third. A fourth blow caught him square in the forehead and propelled him along the counter to the corner of the room where he stood with his hands covering his face. "Come on," his father said, and he advanced on him again. "Come on, fight back like a man. Come on, little boy, let's see what you're made of." Wade yanked his hands away and thrust his face open-eyed at his father and cried, "I'm not made of what you're made of," and Pop hit him again, slamming Wade's head back against the wall. Wade covered his face with his hands once more, and he began to cry. Pop turned away in disgust. "You sure ain't," he said, and he walked over to the door, where he turned back to Wade and said, "Next time you start telling your father what to do and what not to do, make damn sure you can back it up, buddy boy." Then he went out, slamming the door behind him. Wade let himself slide slowly down to the floor, where he sat with his legs straight out, his head slumped on one shoulder, his arms flopped across his lap, a marionette with its strings cut.
Well, it's a terrific scene. You know, the two brothers in this book, one of them, Wade, who is in the scene that you just read, decides to fight back at some point, whereas his other brother, his younger brother, Rolf, learns to hang his head in shame and back away, something he learned from his mother. When you were growing up in a family with an abusive father, did that seem like the two alternatives, to hang your head in shame and back away, or to learn how to fight back?
Yeah, I think that, for a boy, that's certainly the two alternatives, because you can imagine and you internalize early and then later put into action that fantasy of revenge, of fighting back. And Wade's taken that route, despite its destructiveness in his life. And then, or you can run. You can be the denier, in a sense. You can cut yourself off from others and remove yourself from family or community and all forms of intimacy, like Rolf, the narrator of the book.
Which did you do?
Well, in a sense, I did both, I think, at different stages of my life. When I was very young, I mean, when I was in my late teens, early 20s, and so on, I was one of those turbulent, violent young men, always on the edge of exploding, and oftentimes actually exploding, a barroom brawler kind of person that society has kind of mixed feelings about. On the one hand, he's often attractive and the hero of a lot of films and television specials and so forth. On the other hand, he's a repugnant and a chaotic individual. And then later, I think I went through a period of my life where I was distanced and detached and protected myself and protected others through that.
Mm-hmm. Novelist Russell Banks is my guest, and we're talking about his new novel, Affliction. Is the scene that you just read a scene from personal experience?
Well, to some degree. In terms of the boy wanting to defend his mother and understanding his role in the family as that was certainly something that I experienced emotionally and situationally, not necessarily at the same age or exactly the same circumstances. And then failing to be a man, as it were, in those terms that the father was defining, to rise to that occasion, failing to become that person. So that's the essence of that scene, is that the challenge is thrown down, be a man, and to be a man he's got to fight him, and not be a victim, not just be beaten by him.
So was there a point in your life when you figured out that there was another way to define manhood?
Yes. Surely. I think that, you know, I think one knows these things, and you don't have to figure them out. It's pretty apparent what's good and what's bad behavior. But there are powerful compulsions that grow out of this situation, this context in of a childhood's a child's life, and the compulsions get enacted despite what you've figured out and what you know, and that's where the pain and shame come into it, because men who beat their wives, no matter how much it gets reinforced by the society at large, nevertheless know that it's wrong, and what they're acting out of is some strange and powerful compulsion.
Ralph, the brother who withdraws, says at one point, "I became a careful adult. It may have been a high price to pay, never having been carefree, but at least I avoided being afflicted by the man's violence." But he kind of comes to realize that there's other kinds of affliction from this violence, too.
That's
which
right.
is the knowledge that you're withdrawing from life to protect
That's
yourself.
Right.
And I was wondering at what point you started to realize that, and also to fear this kind of deeper affliction, that it's something that you would carry, that in a way someone who came from an abusive family might mm-hmm. be something of a time bomb themselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, Rolf is sort of whistling in the dark there in the passage you quoted, and part of his telling of the story is a way of his realizing that he is whistling in the dark, so that the last lines of the book, in a way, are his gradual admission that he's still locked in some way. And that's certainly the first step toward perhaps release from the situation. My own case, it's hard to say. This is a process and a lifelong one. I've been writing about this kind of men and boys for most of my career in one way or the other, most of the time, and I think less so now, indirectly and obliquely. But as my own emotional life has become a little bit less tangled and turbulent and conflicted, I've been able, as a writer, to approach the characters and the world that they live in more directly. You want to go a little further on it, because I wanted to say that as a novelist, I have I have access to certain tools and strategies, I guess, for lack of a better word, that perhaps a person normally doesn't have, just because, for instance, memory is a crucial, a novelist's tool that has to be cultivated and preserved. And so I'm forced again and again through that to go back to my own childhood. The language of fiction ends up eventually betraying you if you aren't telling the truth, and so is my attention to my craft and attention to language has forced me to perhaps, you know, to deal with the truth of the matter more than I might have otherwise if I were, if I ran a used car lot or if I were a lawyer or something.
I want to ask you about the narration, the way
right.
you chose the narrative structure for the book.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of complicated narrative structure in the sense that it's narrated by the withdrawn brother
mm-hmm.
who's telling the story of his older brother, the brother mm-hmm. who becomes violent himself.
Mm-hmm.
And so the story we're reading is primarily the story of the older brother as told
yeah.
by the younger brother, but we sometimes almost forget that the younger brother's telling it because
right.
we're seeing it so much through the eyes of the older brother. Surely there would have been a simpler way
well,
of telling
there,
it. Tell me why
yeah.
you chose this
well,
kind
Well, it
of
might
structure.
Have been a simpler way, but then it might have also misled or misrepresented the, I should say, and anyway, any other way to tell the story wouldn't have been able for me to have told the story. I told it this way because the particular story seemed to demand it. It's not as complicated as it might seem. Partially, I think we're in a way, over the last decade or so, as readers in America anyhow, have been seduced by the power and brilliance of a lot of writers' work, mostly what are generally called minimalist writers, into a fairly simplistic idea of what a narrator is or can do. And we've forgotten that the tradition of realism in fiction is much wider than that, and my narrator is essentially the same kind of narrator that Melville uses in Bartleby the Scrivener. It's a guy telling a story about another person, and in the process of telling the story about this other person, comes to a deeper understanding of himself and his connections to the other person.
We'll have more of Terry's interview with novelist Russell Banks in just a moment. This is Fresh Air. Russell Banks is the author of Affliction, which has just been made into a new film. He spoke with Terry Gross in 1989.
You know, by writing a novel that everyone will assume is at least partly autobiographical about family abuse, domestic abuse, you know that when you're interviewed, you're going to be asked about how much is autobiographical and about violence in your family and everything. And I'm wondering if... If when you decided to do interviews about the book, mm-hmm. if you felt comfortable with that, especially with us interviewers, you know, we always try to make connections between the life and the work, and you know, I don't know if you feel like just because you're writing this book that you have to come clean about everything that's happened in your life,
and I believe me, I won't. But but I think that yes, I know that. Even if you write a book that's about Martians, people will ask you about that connection between the author and the fictional characters and so forth. And the standard response is, I think, the reasonable one, which is there's no connection whatsoever. I just made it up, as it were. But and I know, though, with a novel like this and so forth, it's more likely to invite it. I have gone ahead and acknowledged in numerous places that there are real connections between my own childhood experience and the experience of Wade Whitehouse and Rolf Whitehouse for a couple of reasons, when I would just as soon, frankly, say no, none whatsoever. I just, you know, read about it in the papers. I guess because I think, and this in some ways separates me as a writer from the book, and just talks about it, I don't want to talk about it then, just as a man who happened to come up in a family that was marked by violence. I think that it's probably a useful thing to do, to come out and say it and admit it and say that, this happened to me, and I went through a long period of my life where I was ashamed, and that the shame is one of the ways in which you continue that syndrome. And the loneliness and alienation that you feel because of it is one of the ways in which it perpetuates itself. So by speaking of it and conceding that, you know, this occurred in my life, I think I'm also in some way contributing to breaking down that syndrome a little bit. I think if more of us did it, I mean, these things, afflictions of this sort, sexual abuse, violent domination of people by each other in a family and so forth, are perpetuated and fed by secrecy and silence. So I don't know how else I could respond to the questions without saying, yeah, you're right, it did happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't die, you know. and it caused a great deal of pain and confusion in my life and in the life of people close to me. But in time, I managed to, I think... break that syndrome.
Unlike the father in your novel who outlives the mother, your father left the family when you were 12. Do you feel in a way lucky that he did, so that you and your mother were no longer exposed to his violence?
Well, certainly when you remove the key figure in the family, you break the syndrome, but you also break all other kinds of relationship down in a way. When he left, we also lost our father, and lots of other aspects to his life were gone from our life, and so we then became, my mother in a sense became one of these single parents with four small children. I was the oldest at 12, and so there were other kinds of consequences. So I couldn't say it was a good thing. What happened, I think, was just a dysfunctional family became dysfunctional in another way at 12. My relationship with my father had a blank that went from age 12 to about 18 when I reestablished contact with him and reconnected to him and spent the next decade or so of my life in some ways trying to come to know him and to know myself in his world. And so I wasn't, you know, without a father.
I want to read a sentence from your novel that I particularly like. Wade was the third child in a taciturn family that left children early to their own devices, as if there were nothing coming in adult life worth preparing them for. Hmm. Is that the kind of upbringing you felt you had? I like the sentence a lot. I like the way you describe that.
I don't think that I had that kind of upbringing altogether, no. No, that's a little grimmer than I had. I think, though, I'm taking something that I know firsthand to some degree and also having witnessed it in other lives. I'm talking about lives with low expectations and people who, in a sense, don't respect their childhood because they don't believe that their lives can ever amount to anything anyhow.
The novel's set in a small town in New England, and you describe it as the kind of town that people leave but that no one comes back to. And the character who's narrating this describes how he hates to go home on the holidays and that he has to be coerced into it by guilt, tricked, if not by himself, then by the wider sentimental culture.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. And I was wondering what you were thinking of when you were thinking of the wider sentimental culture. You know, and tricking someone like him to go home to this small town he was so happy to escape.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think he says that he especially doesn't like to go home on the holidays. And I think that this is the song, Home for the Holidays, and White Christmas, and all our associations with holidays, I think, are manipulative and deceitful in some way. Especially for those of us whose families don't correspond to that family that sits around the loaded board in a kind of golden haze. Cheerfully having just opened up all their wonderful Christmas gifts and so forth. The wider sentimental culture seems to obviously it creates and perpetuates and then finally exploits a myth of family that doesn't really exist except in, you know, our dreams, and so that most of us go through lives feeling that our families are somehow exceptions and failures, and these cross patches that we spent our childhood are inadequate and shameful failures.
Russell Banks is the author of the novel Affliction, which has been made into a movie that's coming out in theaters now. I'm Dean Ulsher, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we hear from one of the stars of Affliction, Nick Nolte. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by pianist Tommy Flanagan, and film critic John Powers reviews the new film Hillary and Jackie. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dean Olscher. Nick Nolte is starring in two films now that critics love. One is Affliction. Nolte plays the character Wade, who lives with the legacy of his abusive alcoholic father. Here, Wade's daughter, played by Bridget Tierney, has just come back from trick-or-treating and starts a conversation about Halloween pranks.
Did you do that stuff when you were a kid?
No. Well, sort of. You know, nothing really mean. Me and my pals, me and my brothers. It's kind of funny then.
But it's not funny now.
No, it's not funny now. I'm a cop. I gotta listen to the complaints people make. I'm not a kid anymore. You change.
I bet you did a lot of bad stuff when you were a kid.
What are you talking about?
I don't know. I just think you used to be bad.
No. I didn't used to be bad. No, sir.
Nolte's also starring in The Thin Red Line, directed by Terrence Malick. It's a World War II film which takes place on Guadalcanal. Nolte plays Battalion Commander Lieutenant Colonel Gordon Tall.
John, I'm convinced that the Japanese position can be broken right now. All we have to do is keep going and we'll have this hill. We'll have this hill by sundown. You see the spirit in these men? You see the new spirit? Well, I want to take advantage of that before something happens to sap their strength. To have this battalion relieved in a defeat, or even to have it reinforced from troops from a reserve regiment if we were stalled before reaching the top, well, that's just a hell of a lot more than I could stand. I've waited all my life for this. I've worked, slaved, eaten old, untold buckets of to have this opportunity. I don't intend to give it up now. You don't know what it feels like to be passed over. I mean, you're young. You're just out of the academy. You got your war. This is 15 years. This is my first war. Someday you'll understand.
Nick Nolte talked with Terry Gross a year ago when his film Afterglow was in theaters.
Nick Nolte, welcome to Fresh Air. The film critic David Thompson has a little profile of you in his Encyclopedia of Film. I don't know if you've read it or not, but he says, Nolte is a subject for rejoicing and great hope, for we face the rest of this century with at least one actor capable of playing large, mature, but deeply troubled men. What do you think of that description?
I think that's just all right.
Yeah. What about the large, mature, but deeply troubled men? Do you think of that as a kind of role that you often play?
No, I don't. I just think that's the way the world is. So I assume the world is much like myself. I mean, if you look at the world, it's violent. And it always has been for thousands of years. This seems to be the nature of mankind. Violence is in biological imperative for some reason. So I, in my work, am going after what I see in the world. I'm trying to translate that because I have this terrible urge and need to do this, not for any other reason than to do this, or otherwise I just don't think that I just don't respond healthily any other way to society. When I grew up in the 50s, I grew up in a rough time. For me, I considered it a rough time. It was a time when I, as a little child, looked up and saw large adults competing very heavily with one another in a kind of violent way. It was a time of great secrecy, great conformity. If you didn't conform, you were in terrible trouble with the authorities and very strict rules. And on top of that, we always had to climb under our desk because we were going to be obliterated any second into ashes. So you had one or two choices as a child in that kind of a world. Either conform to it and get as invisible as possible, or rebel. And that's why I, you know, have been enraged all my life.
Well, you said that, you know, you act because, how did you put it?
It's a psychological or biological imperative, or certainly a psychological one. I mean,
but it's interesting because you didn't start doing it until fairly late in life for an actor. I think you weren't even on the stage till your early 20s. Your first big role came when you were about 35 on Rich Man, Poor Man.
Right.
What got you on the stage in the first place? You'd been better known for football. You had a football college scholarship.
Yes, but the football thing is, if you really study the situation. I became a football player when I did North Dallas 40, and that's the odd part of it. I played a football player in a movie, and then from then on, I became this great football player. I was a very minor athlete, in truth. I was quite frankly wandering around this country in the early 60s, late 50s, from Mexico to all around, hanging out in universities for short periods of times, searching, and psychologically very screwed up.
Searching
for some place to be comfortable in a world that was just a very uncomfortable place, you know. Vietnam hadn't happened yet. Really, it was still under the 50s guise of everybody fit in conformity. I must say that my whole personality and psyche and everything became extremely peaceful during the 60s because I was no longer one of the minority. I became the majority as we revolted and rebelled against Vietnam and all of that kind of thing, and we stopped going into the classes, and a lot of things changed. But I saw a play that was specifically about situations. It was Death of a Salesman and such situations that I was going through. So I saw this, and I said, Jesus, you know, this is something that I can be involved in. I can read it, I can watch it, and you can also become part of it. So I got up on stage, and it was that horrible experience, that absolute horror. Your worst nightmare to be on stage, but at the same time, there was an underneath feeling that this was home. You were home.
As a younger man, you were convicted of a felony of selling counterfeit draft cards. What were you selling them for? What was this so underage drinkers could drink? I mean, what was the point of the counterfeit draft cards?
The point of the counterfeit draft cards was to undermine the American government. Basically, undermine the war effort. Started out just so that we could undermine the law against drinking alcohol when everybody else got to. And then it slowly progressed into undermining the American government. And the crux of the matter and where it became the big difficulty was that it was a political act. That's what they classified it as.
You were given a suspended sentence, but you were fined $75,000. Did you have to pay the fine?
No.
That was suspended too?
The sentence was $75,000 fine, 45 years in jail, 7 counts of counterfeit government documents. Suspended that and gave me under Youth Correction Act, which means that after my probation period, it's supposedly to be wiped off my record, but the National Enquirer found out about it and tried to blackmail me on it, and I called Rona Barrett and said, well, can I come in and confess on your show? And she said, sure, and I came in and confessed, and then they stopped blackmailing me on it.
What was the impact of the confession?
Secrecy of government issue. You know.
What was the impact of the confession?
The impact of the confession was that Rona had no idea what I was going to confess to, and I just threw it out there to the over the national television, and so the Enquirer backed off. They had no story. But Rona then asked me about drugs in America and how bad marijuana was, and I went on to defend that there was nothing wrong with a marijuana plant in itself. It's us that the problem lies, and she's was against the plant itself, and so I caught her off guard, and she wanted to reshoot it, and I refused to. And so she never liked me after that. So then I kept appearing in her magazine with little quotes underneath, and what is Nick on today?
Well, you did have drug and alcohol problems for a while. Did that have a bad impact on your ability to act?
No, it never carried over into my work, at least not that I think of, but I'm sure it impacted everything. I mean, yeah, I indulged out. I drank the bottom out of the bottle. I drank down to the worm. And eventually it didn't work for me anymore. As I said, I'm a very uncomfortable person in the world. And so drugs and alcohol worked for me a while to make me comfortable. And then after a while, it didn't work, and it started to actually kill me.
As we were talking about, you know, you started acting, you know, comparatively late. One of the things you're known for in the acting world, I understand, is doing whatever you need to do to get into character. The example that's always used is like for Beverly Hills, for Down and Out in Beverly Hills. You actually lived in a skid row for a while, didn't bathe or brush your teeth for a while you were playing a homeless guy. Do you think that part of the reason why you take that kind of approach to get into a role is because you didn't like start training, you know, for a stage career when you were 17 or something like that? Did you feel like you had to really throw yourself into it once you started?
No. There again, you got to draw a distinction between what acting is. You know, my idea of acting, which is my idea because it is my life, is that it's some kind of internal rhythm that I have to do. It's something I need to do. I need to go down on Skid Row and live like a man on the street as well as I can, because I need to understand that. I'm not doing it to make $1 million, and I'm not doing it to get a lot of fame. I'm doing it because this provides me the opportunity to go down on the street. And it's not so much to get into the role, but acting is behavior to me. It's not putting on a good show, you know. It's not applaud me. It's something I need to do.
So
it's my life, you know.
So what did you do on Skid Row when you were researching the
movie? I walked around and I sat down with a guy named Al, and he asked me if I had a cigarette, and we were drinking wine, and I gave him a cigarette, and he grabbed me and gave me a big hug, and he started bawling, and he said, "I'm sorry, Pete, I'm so goddamn sorry, I'm just sorry, I'm sorry." And I said, "It's all right, it's all right," and I patted him on the back. Tremendous pain, tremendous. The streets are not about homelessness, it's about hopelessness, you know?
If you're playing a homeless person, you have the option of, you know, living on the street for a while. But say you're doing a role like Afterglow, where you're playing a carpenter and contractor who is very popular with single women and unhappily married women because they can flirt with him and sometimes even make it with him. And his own marriage, he loves his wife, but his marriage is they're kind of estranged in their own way. It's a kind of complicated character study. It's a character study that's both a comedy and a drama. There's no, like, kind of Skid Row. There's no, like, extreme to go to as part of the research for a movie like that. Do you know what I mean? So what do you do to get into a character who's a guy, who's a kind of real guy?
Well, I hung out with carpenters. I hung out with, guys that did this kind of stuff. Just a little bit. I mean, I wanted to get the physicality right. I wanted to be able to handle a hammer. I wanted to know how
to look right under the sink.
Yeah, I wanted to build a wall. I wanted to know how to build a wall.
Uh-huh.
The physicality of Lucky was a different thing. I had to build him out of what kind of physical activity he does, you know, so I wanted to do that, and then, you know, you draw from what the story is told from your own life, you know, your relationships and things in that. And since I know nobody, absolutely nobody in this world that has a perfect relationship, I had wealth of material to draw upon.
Nick Nolte spoke with Terry Gross a year ago. He's currently starring in two films, The Thin Red Line and Affliction. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead takes a listen to the latest from pianist Tommy Flanagan. This is Fresh Air. Pianist Tommy Flanagan comes from Detroit, where he began playing in jazz clubs before moving to New York in 1956. Before long, he'd appeared on classic LPs like the Sonny Rollins album Saxophone Colossus and John Coltrane's Giant Steps, and he'd begun his long, off-and-on gig as Ella Fitzgerald's accompanist, a job he finally gave up in 1978. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Flanagan is rightly regarded as one of the most lyrical pianists in jazz, and that a new live recording is an accurate portrait of the artist.
Still burying time capsules, those boxes of artifacts meant to give future generations a glimpse of our time? If so, and they want to show what a typical set in a New York jazz club is like, they might include Tommy Flanagan's CD, Sunset and the Mockingbird. It was recorded at the Village Vanguard on Flanagan's 67th birthday last year. It's not spectacular, but this recital is solid as teak. It's jazz by the rule book, an up-tempo number, a slow ballad, a Latin tune, long solos capped by fast exchanges between the soloist and the drummer, and deft quotes from old tunes, sometimes so sly only the hippest listeners spot them. It's typical in a good way. That's what the wisdom of experience sounds like, the sound of 50 years on the job. Tommy Flanagan plays too much piano to be a minimalist, but he always sounds like he's pared his lines back to only the notes that need playing. He knows when to invent and when to let a melody's own power take over. This is Sunset and the Mockingbird, one of Duke Ellington's compositions inspired by bird calls. When Tommy Flanagan was coming up, jazz was a young man's game because of its physical demands and because each generation reinvented the music, rolling over grandpa in the process. In the 1980s, Wynton Marsalis and friends proposed a jazz with no future except one found in its glorious past. Those players soon dominated the marketplace and the press, and yet by looking to the past, the young lions necessarily and even willingly ceded leadership of jazz to older musicians. Musicians who'd invented what the youngers wanted to emulate. You could say that for Tommy Flanagan, jazz is living music, while for generations of players behind him, it's classical music, a fixed historical style to be reverently interpreted. But what the new mainstream lacks in original solo voices, it makes up for with excellent service-oriented rhythm players, like Flanagan's bassist, Peter Washington. He teams up here with the great 40-ish drummer, Lewis Nash. Something else nice about the CD, it really sounds like you're in the Village Vanguard. The low ceiling in that hallowed basement gives the drums a peculiar dry sound that really comes across here. The only thing missing is someone talking loud at the next table. I hope by the time Tommy Flanagan turns 67, he realized he'd finally done something he may have thought impossible. He'd become so respected in his own right, he was no longer known just as Ella Fitzgerald's old piano player. So, happy birthday, Mr. Flanagan. You deserve every good thing you get.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of the book New Dutch Swing. He reviewed Sunset and the Mockingbird by pianist Tommy Flanagan. Coming up, we'll have a review of the new film Hillary and Jackie. This is Fresh Air. The new movie Hillary and Jackie is not about first ladies. It's the story of the complicated relationship between Hilary Dupré and her sister Jacqueline, the English cellist who died of multiple sclerosis when she was 42. Rachel Griffiths plays Hilary and Emily Watson stars as Jackie. Film critic John Powers has this review.
The wonder of genius is that it knows no limitations. The horror is that you have to live with it. The abyss between these two lies at the heart of a fascinating new film, Hilary and Jackie, the story of the two Dupré sisters. It begins during their 50s girlhood in London, when Hills, as she's known, appears to be the more gifted of the two. But she's too pliant for greatness and is soon left in the dust by Jackie, a flamboyant prodigy who jets around the world, bathes in adulation, and enters a glitzy marriage to the dashing Argentine pianist Daniel Barenboim. Of course, genius shares a border with madness, and fame quickly transforms Jax, as she's known, into a monster of selfishness and self-destruction. Meanwhile, Hillary settles into an ordinary happy life with a hearty conductor named Kiffer Finzi, played a little too heartily by David Morrissey, who gives her the love and security that she needs. From the moment Jackie meets Kiffer, she begins to envy Hillary's happiness, and their relationship turns prickly, sometimes even cruel.
You can't just leave me.
I'm not leaving you. You're not here anymore.
You never will be again.
Haven't you heard? I'm giving up the cello.
Oh, don't be silly.
I can do what I want.
You don't know anything apart from the cello. I don't know anything apart from the flute. We're babies, Jax. And Kiffer laughs at me.
Then why are you marrying him?
Because he makes me feel special.
Well, that's a big squeeze, because the truth is, you're not special.
I thought you'd be happy for me.
It's scenes like this one, when Jackie's at her most vicious, that have scandalized many classical music fans, especially in Britain. They feel that the movie, based on Hillary and her brother's memoir, A Genius in the Family, uses the words of resentful siblings to trash the memory of a British icon. And it's true that the movie shows the dark side of Jackie, a creature of bottomless self-absorption. She expects everyone to do her bidding and demands constant proofs of love. As part of this yearning, she even guilt-trips Hillary into letting her sleep with Kiffer. Yet Hillary and Jackie is not a hatchet job, but an attempt to explore the deep, tricky relationship between two sisters, a relationship whose complications even they don't fully grasp. Far from simply debunking Jackie, director Anand Tucker uses his restless style to make us aware of the subjectivity of human truth. This idea is underscored by a bold storytelling gambit. just at the moment we really start hating Jackie for her hysterical egomania, the movie suddenly pivots. It flashes back to events we've previously witnessed from Hillary's point of view, including that conversation about being special, a conversation that Jackie experienced in a radically different way. Viewed through Jackie's own eyes, her unforgivable behavior starts to make sense. We understand why she covets Hillary's homely existence. Success has left this naive young prodigy empty, uprooted, and slashing her wrists lonely. Her brilliant career has become her Calvary, the cello, her cross. On the face of it, Hillary and Jackie may sound a bit like Shine, another biographical film about a stricken musician. But this new movie is far smarter and more emotionally gripping. Because it cuts so close to the bone, Hillary and Jackie's story winds up being extraordinarily moving, especially in its use of Elgar's starkly majestic Concerto for Cello in E minor. Yet the movie's real power comes from its stars. As she showed in Breaking the Waves, Emily Watson has no peer at playing women possessed by demons. Whether she's grinning with mad girl glee, orgasmically fingering her cello, or issuing orders with a minor deity's sense of entitlement, her Jackie is constantly throwing herself off psychic cliffs and hoping Hillary will catch her. Watson's bravura is matched by Rachel Griffith's touching restraint as Hillary, a down-to-earth woman torn between resenting her troublesome sister and doing what she can to save her. Griffith's beautifully modulated performance turns Hillary's decent normalcy into a form of heroism. She's not a genius. Her talent is knowing how to love another person, even when that person is a royal pain.
John Powers is the film critic for Vogue. This Friday archive edition of Fresh Air was produced by Roberta Shorrock and executive producer Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show today. Terry Gross returns on Monday. I'm Dean Olsher.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Peter Guralnick. His second volume on The King, called Careless Love, The Unmaking of Elvis Presley, has just been published. Join us for the next Fresh Air.